Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
The Word is proud media partner of Latitude Festival.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Latitude Festival. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you to the weather for making everybody come into a dry tent. I think the tradition at festivals is you chant no more rain. No, it's the rain. The tradition of festivals, you chant no more rain, isn't it? But we've been back going, more rain, more rain.
More rain.
So my name's Andrew Harrison of The Word magazine. With me, I have, he came from Wigan in the search for knowledge. He studied teacher training at Edgehill College. Your friend and mine, the great Stuart McConey.
Thank you.
And we're here to talk about Britpop, which Stuart and I invented, didn't we? We invented Britpop.
Do you know what? You laugh. But there is a case for saying that we did. So this is the bit we can talk about before Louise gets here and says that bands were doing it.
Yeah, she'll tell them they lied to you. So, Stuart, when you and I invented Britpop...
That day we invented Britpop,
Tell the viewers about how we invented Britpop. We didn't really.
Let me tell you a little bit. Well, you know what? You said that. There's a case for saying that we almost did. And that's not just arrogance. That's just... Anyway, let me tell you a bit of the backstory. Because I came of the backstory of this, I was working for the NME at the time, and I remember one day we were at the NME. The music we were writing about was uniformly dire. It was at the height of grunge, but not the good grunge, not Nirvana, but all those people. Well, we put a band called Superchunk on the cover one week, and I basically wept bitter tears in the office and pounded the floor and said, "This cannot go on."
Yes.
You know, and because I hated all that music, I hated the way they dressed, I hated everything about it. And then I went to Japan with Blur at the time of Modern Life is Rubbish, and came back with this messianic zeal, like, you know, what's that famous thing about Bruce Springsteen? I have seen the future of rock and roll, and its name is Bruce Springsteen. But I came back saying, "This is it. This is what we should be writing about. They're young, they're British, they make cool, short, sexy songs that aren't, you know, I don't want to tidy my room, essentially. And they're great, and they're, you know, everything's going to be great." And people said, "No, this is terrible." Anyway, there was... And I think just about after that, I realised my days there were numbered.
Mm.
And then a sinister Svengali-like figure approached me, Bernstein and Woodward style, in the car park... And basically we started... And you were of a similar mind, really, weren't you?
Well, I was editing Select magazine at the time.
Yeah.
And it was my first proper real job. And I, much like Stuart and many other people, hated having to shovel this dreadful plaid-clad American awful drivel music into the magazine, because it was what was around, and it was very hard work, and none of us in the office had any particular passion for it. What we wanted, we would play the Denim album all day, which nobody bought, but it was fantastic, and it was English, and it said things about our lives, and we loved it. We loved Saint Etienne, even though they could barely sell a record. They could also be relied upon. If you had a hole in the magazine at the last minute, you could ring up and say, get Saint Etienne to come to the office and bake biscuits or something, or get them to go and wear a sandwich one. They would do it. They were in reception. But we loved all that music. We had very little connection to the American bands, and we felt there was something in the air. And Stuart and also Andrew Collins were kind of coming to the end of their time at the NME. And they were obviously, you know, Stuart's one of the most fantastic writers around. We really, really, really wanted to sign him, chiefly because we wanted to cause the NME pain. It was our mission in life to be mean to the NME. And so this plot was cooked up, wasn't it? That British music wasn't just a kind of a background noise, that it should be what we were concentrating upon.
Yeah.
And the old trick in the music press was always, when it's a quiet week, invent a scene. Invent a scene.
No.
These scenes including, Fraggle Rock?
Fraggle Rock.
What else?
Andrew and I and David Quanti, because a kind of ironic anti-scene joke, had once tried to start a scene called Lion Pop.
Lion with Cud.
Lion Pop, I'd only had Cud, I think.
Yes.
St. Etienne might have been in Lion Pop as well, you know. Always trying to invent a scene. But this was more. There was more to it than this. And also, as well as this, I'd had this kind of sort of Damascene is the word I'm looking for, conversion with Blur in Japan. And also, there were a few bands beginning to knock around.
Yeah.
Pulp, I'd made Legendary Girlfriend, single of the week in NME, and Pulp had started to kind of take off again a bit. There were bands who were looking different and sounding different, with specifically British or even specifically English points of reference. And so we started to talk.
Yes.
And we met. This is when Britpop the movie is made. I feel sure it will be. We met in a pub. I can't remember which one. Was it
the Clacken? Maybe possibly.
When we met in a pub in London. And you said, right, tell me what you wanted to write about, yeah.
I wanted to fill the magazine with British bands who were singing about things that mattered to British people.
Yeah.
And Stuart wanted to write about
them. Which makes it sound all slightly like the Nazis now, doesn't it?
Well,
but really, it wasn't like
this
that.
This brings us on to,
we can talk about that in a moment, yeah.
From this came the infamous Brett from Suede on the cover with a Union Jack up behind him.
Which he didn't speak to me for about 4 years over.
He's forgiven me now,
yeah. Right. Yeah.
And Suede, they were sort of John the Baptist to the whole thing. They tend to get written out of the Britpop story now. But they really did start, they began all these many other, one of the things that I think we referred to them as, before we started talking about Britpop, we call it crimpolinism.
That's right.
Because Suede and Pulp were all wearing these horrible man-made fibres that would make electric sparks arc off them.
Yeah.
Stuart's wearing a very well-made and lovely and organic version. Well, they looked like that, but they were made out of petrol byproducts instead. Stuart's is raw cotton harvested by real humans. So there's Suede on the front of the NME. Select, with a Union Jack in the background. And God rest his soul, Stephen Wells went spare, didn't he?
He went mental.
He went, I mean, the late, great Stephen Wells, who passed away a couple of years ago, who's a great friend to many of us in here, and a giant of music journalism.
He went mad.
He said, in an article in The Enemy, he said, "You are serving the purposes of Nazism."
Yeah. Which some people thought was a slight overreaction.
It was a little bit, yes.
Including me. No, but we sat in the pub and we said, right, what should we do? Because we made it into it's become quite a legendary edition. It's got a picture of Brett Anderson on the front with a Union Jack and Britain, and it says, and the headline is, "Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Cobain?"
Yes. Is it Yaks Go Home, it says, as well, doesn't it?
Does it?
Yes.
Right, okay.
Which my wife, an American, thinks is just great. Yeah. Okay, I will then.
So, and it was a kind of theme issue, wasn't it,
yes,
in a way? Because there was a Suede interview,
mm-hmm,
but I also wrote things like, there was also something like Victor Meldrum, Morecambe and Wise,
yes,
and stuff, and what things distinguished us from the contemporary American
Stuart
culture.
Stuart wrote an amazing creed de coeur about what it is to be proud of your English culture and how you shouldn't just think that it's
like Nick Griffin now.
No. That pop culture is what, and an outward looking and an inclusive pop culture that does include, that includes black music and includes other musics and includes things from across the spectrum, that's what it is to be English and to be British. Stephen Wells didn't like this at all.
No.
But the feature also contained, we had the Auteurs in there.
Yeah, we did.
We had Denim in there. We had Pulp in there. We didn't have Blur and we didn't have Oasis.
Did we not?
We didn't, no.
Oh, well, to be fair about Oasis, were they going at this point?
I don't think they were.
Right, yeah.
No, they were not going at this point.
No, but Blur certainly were, yeah, yeah.
So this then, we went from a situation where the NME refused to countenance this and think that it was actually morally wrong, to within a year, they were running their own Union Jack front covers with Noel Gallagher with the Union Jack guitar. Union Jacks were everywhere.
That's right.
So not only did we invent Britpop, we also invented the Union Jack, didn't we, Stuart? Or, I should say, the Union flag. Only the Union Jack when flown at sea, as everyone knows. So that's kind of how we got this. Are these the legs of Louise Winner coming through the... No, it's not.
No.
So
it's great. It's like some pop star leg quiz.
But one of the... I think Stuart just touched upon it a minute ago. One of the strange things about...
And we were right.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, Louise Wanner. Hooray! Hello, hello.
Oh, there's biscuits and everything.
There's biscuits that Louise Wanner is now taking up her position and having a biscuit.
I'm going to show you. That's him. He's just texting me. Sorry, Louise, sit down.
Right.
We were just... You can give your version. No, in a minute. We were talking about... Was Sleeper in it? Or was Sleeper not really going by that stage?
Sleeper were not. We were talking about the infamous issue of Select that invented Britpop and put Brett on the front with the Union Jack and all that kind of thing.
We went, why weren't we?
You were in your gestatory phase then, weren't you?
Yes, we were gestatory.
Yeah.
So,
but we were just talking about its origins and that issue and from our point of view as music journalists, at the time I'd been to Japan with Blur and was really sick of grunge music and started to start thinking there is this other kind of sound, you know.
Absolutely,
British,
yeah.
Which we put into this
special issue.
So yeah. Who do you think you're kidding, Mr. Colbert? Well, from your point of view then,
yeah.
Being about, were you motivated by similar things? Were you sitting around thinking, I hate all this American music? And, or not?
Me, no. I thought, well, look, that's what they're doing now, so if I do that, maybe we'll get in the charts.
Is that what you thought?
That's what I thought.
No, you didn't.
I did. I yeah? swear.
Before that, did you have your kind of own plaid clad grunge phase beforehand? With
like... We had folk phase. We had, you were like Tanita Tikram for a long while. You know, it
very
was
nice.
Like when we were sort of a bit, yes. And then we tried to be a bit sort of Manchester.
Right.
That didn't work.
That was when we made
strangely. And then it was kind of went grunge. And I know I really was into the whole sort of... all the sort of Riot Girl stuff, so that yeah. was part of that. Certainly was a real thing that kind of yes. sort of started me off on it. But you know, in all honesty, we were a bit sort of kind of, what can we do? What can we do? We've been trying to make it for years,
right?
Maybe
okay.
this would be the thing. Yeah,
well, that's why we didn't put them in then,
because they were still,
but it did, actually,
it, it did actually fit you though, didn't it?
I can say all that now. At the time, you weren't allowed to say stuff like that, but I don't care anymore. So.
No. that's well, yeah, well, we get it all on the table now. Yeah, it did fit you like a glove, though.
It
took your style of writing.
Yeah, no, it was perfect. It was just kind of, it was a bit like sort of, it felt like sort of coming home, sort of finding your space and sort of seeing that that was the thing that we could do and that was the thing that I could manage yeah. and really sort of pull off properly, you know,
yeah.
and love as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, certainly, I mean, as a music journalist at the time, I was seeing all these bands like Pulp appear and, you know, Suede, and they looked so odd. They were peculiar looking people. They didn't look like musicians should look like. They looked like they were out of the pages of the Beano. They're either too tall or too thin or weird looking people.
Skinny people, tall people, yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was a classic thing, wasn't there? I think it was in Smash Hits, and they actually had a big headline saying, "Who are all these weirdos in the charts?"
Is that right?
Fantastic.
Because it was suddenly they were seeing all these kind of indie bands coming through and then becoming pop, being on top of the pops, being in the top 20.
Mm.
I was like, who are they? Who are these weirdos? And that was kind of, and that was quite brilliant, I think.
It was quite liberating as well because you know, the music journalists here, you know, we're not Stuart, but me certainly, we kind of have faces for radio, and you know, we tend to be of the weirdo, you know,
yeah,
we don't
absolutely.
Look like Ross, you know.
No, yeah.
So
no.
You're going to feel like these are your own people finally making it, and you can kind of, in your own small way, help out.
Yeah. And it was, but there was that reaction. There definitely was that reaction that Swells had. That I all the time, I kept getting called a little Englander, a phrase that I still don't know what it means. What does that mean if you're a little Englander?
I think little.
You don't apply it to people who live in South Africa.
I don't know.
And what, and dream of the old country. I don't know. But anyway, I kept getting accused. I kept saying, "Why? What do you mean by that?" Because I said I like some English music. It was fairly... I think some of the stick we took... Admittedly, Blur, I think, came very close with British Image Number... Do you remember British Image
yes.
Number 1, the infamous press photograph, British Image Number 1?
Which was
having some
Doc
big...
Martin boots.
Doc Martin boots.
Is that the dog?
With the dog.
Yeah.
And I understood completely why they were doing it. This was about the same time as Modern Life is Rubbish. I understand completely why they were doing it. It was just to say, no, we're not going to be lank-haired and plaid shirt and all that. Mm. But that was getting... desperately close to something kind of naughty, yeah. But the great Irish writer, Shauna Casey, says, "The English will accept anyone's jingoism except their own."
That's true.
Well.
Which is true.
Do you know what? I think it was also a lot of the time we were sort of objecting to the fact that all those American bands, they sung all these songs being so pissed off at the world. They were so pissed off.
Yeah.
We were like, what are you so pissed off about? You just seem so, just kind of, it seemed very sort of inward looking and complaining and sort of quite, oh, I'm American, I'm going to play like guitar and I'm really pissed
yeah.
off.
Yeah.
So teenage, you know, sort of not in a good, great way.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a bit of a reaction to that. It's sort of, come on, what's your big problem? What are you so
the Americans?
Because it wasn't like they had a theme that they were against. It wasn't, there was nothing sort of particularly political about it or very sort of deep or interesting. It was just, we are...
Yeah. The Americans used to call it complaint rock.
Yes, complaint rock. Exactly.
Yeah.
Complaint rock is what they call it. Yeah, that was my standing joke about it at the time at the NME. I used to say, why are we putting all these bands on the paper whose lyrics are essentially, I didn't ask to be born. basically,
yeah,
it was,
it's that.
I didn't ask to be born. You hate me. You don't understand me. I don't want to tidy my room. And things like that. And
Britpop was just, tidy your room. Get on with it.
Yeah.
Have a tidy room.
Yeah, Britpop
we're
was,
happy
have
with
a tidy
that.
Room
have a tidy
full of good
room.
Stuff.
Keep
yeah.
your room tidy.
Yeah.
A little log of a man putting something into it.
Yeah.
That's what
yes,
it
that'd be quite a good T-shirt,
I do quite like, so, there was almost an element of the perverse of being deliberately perverse. Marquis Smith, the great Marquis Smith. See, it's not taking us... It's taken quite a long time to talk about Marquis Smith, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The great Marquis Smith has that song, Pay Your Rates. Which is obviously deliberately there to wind up complaining political protesters.
Yes.
The chorus of which goes, pay your rates, and pay your water rates.
Yeah.
Which I absolutely love. Yes. I mean, it's not that he really is being so supplicant to authority, but it's just meant to be a joke about those people going, no, I'm not going to knuckle down to the man. And he goes, pay your rates, sir, and pay your water rates.
Yeah, I'm going to bring down society by, you know, cutting down the bin man's overtime.
Exactly.
Please, one of the different things about Britpop was suddenly you had female British artists appearing in bands.
Yeah.
The famous Another Female Fronted Band t-shirt.
Yeah.
Did you feel that Britpop was a feminist issue?
So at the time, it was like none of us wanted to talk about it. And I was, the question that I got asked more than any other question the whole time I was in a band was, what's it like to be a woman in a band? So I got asked that question times to the power of 100. Any other question, and the answer was, I just want to be in a band. I don't want it to, it's not about being a woman in a band. But sort of retrospectively, I feel that it was more, I have more sort of feelings about it probably than I did then. And I think, you know, we were treated much more as novelties. I think we were sort of scrutinized much more. There was so much about whether we were being sexually provocative or we weren't. You know, we all wore big boots. None of us were, I'm wearing a dress today. I didn't wear a dress for about 10 years. Yeah, you know, it's like we wore giant boots, we wore leather jackets, and we're like boys, we had short androgynous haircuts. And I think the way that we thought we could sort of be taken seriously or be recognised within that genre was to ape the sort of male behaviour and the male sort of imagery, I suppose. I don't think we sort of felt that we had to do that.
Isn't it funny though that you're saying you would get questions saying, oh, are you being sexually provocative, are you playing up to being attractive and things like that? Yeah. Because, you know,
I never went on my
because Damon, I've heard a few women of my acquaintance say that he's quite good looking. I don't see it myself, but Damon, no one ever says to Damon, oh, you've cut your hair nice for that photograph, you're playing up, you're being sexually provocative, aren't they?
No.
It's interesting they only would say that to you.
Yes, they would say that a lot.
But they did say it a lot.
And there'd be lots of sort of so people would try and get all the women in bands to sort of wear different things. So you turn up to a photo shoot in your usual Doc Martens and your leather jacket, and they'll go, gosh, she's not wearing that again, is she? Bloody hell.
Oh, really?
Get her in, you know, this, undo a couple of buttons, love. You know, there was all of that
stuff. Really?
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
From the music, I'm not saying this because I think the music press is like politically.
From Select Magazine, I should say.
No.
Wow.
Yes.
That might not have been on my watch, actually. That might not have been on my...
No, that's what Rebecca Brooks said.
I would need
Jezza. Yeah!
No, I
was on holiday at the time that decision was taken.
That does surprise me a little.
It's inconceivable that I would make that decision.
No, yeah.
Yeah, we were hacked all the time.
No, you did get a line of questioning that the bloke bands wouldn't have got. Yeah,
and it was, you know, it was all like... Yeah, it was all of that stuff. It was sort of analysed. And I suppose at the time, I just didn't want to answer this question. I didn't want it to be an issue. I didn't want it to be the thing that defined us. You know, so I didn't want to make a thing, here we are as a female frontier band, that's what's important about us. I just wanted it to piss off and not be a thing.
Yeah.
And of course it was, and you couldn't really escape from it, I suppose.
Yeah. But there were far more women in independent music at the time then, weren't they? You know, it seemed to open a door. And also, you know, you have figures like, you know, Candida and Pulp. You know, she's the keyboard player, she's in the band. Yeah. You know, whether she's a woman or not is kind of irrelevant. Yeah. But the options are there, which didn't seem to really be there in the very, very blokey indie rock of the 80s.
I think that's right. But I think they sort of, it's almost like the record companies then sort of took what we were doing, recognised it, took all that imagery, diluted it, and then sort of gave it on to the pop kittens and for them to have. And they said, we'll take all of that and then we'll just assimilate it and we'll run with it. And then all you can sort of back to your little garages with your guitars, you know. It was kind of
which is what kind of happened, isn't it?
Yes,
it was assimilated very quickly. It wasn't very
quick.
It was a short step from that to Jerry Halliwell's Union Jack dress, wasn't it?
Well, before we get into the sad demise of Britpop, let's talk about the zenith of Britpop. What were the best bits, do we think, Louise? What's the zenith of Britpop being?
I mean, as a movement, I don't really sort of think about it now. I can only sort of think about it in personal terms and what was brilliant for us and what was great for me. It was just, you know, I sort of grew up being a really sort of naff teenager in a little suburb, and I wanted to be a pop star, and I got to do that for a few years. So for me, it was all about that, and it was just the fact that, you know, we got to tour around the world and, you know, play these amazing huge gigs. We supported REM, you know, 70,000 people, huge stadium. And we stood up there and did that, even if it was just for sort of like 25 minutes. It's just, you know, for me, that's just the sort of height of what was great for us.
One of the things that's sort of often said about the bands around that time is that it was surprisingly competitive. That this
was
a new
so
generation of bands.
Was it?
They all
oh
wanted
my
to, you know,
God.
In the way that sort of in like in 1986, the bands on Cherry Red Records were not trying to outdo each other, but at the height of Britpop, it was one up person ship.
I think they were very conscious that there was only enough pie for a certain amount of people. So there was this competition for attention. So also incredible schadenfreude. So if someone had a lower chart position than you, you know, you study people's midweeks. Oh, they got shit midweek. Brilliant. Yeah. You know, they're going down the pan. If there was any minus, you know, microscopic hint that someone might be sort of fading or going down, everyone, you know, it's like celebration time. You know, let's go to the good mixer and celebrate Echo Belly being less good than
us. Cocktails in the blood in the good mixer.
Good mixer.
My God.
God,
this is like something from, you know, Wall Street. Gordon Gekko, they got a shit midweek.
Like
I am Gordon Gekko.
You know, but we all had to pretend we were depending. Yeah, it's a real scene, or we all love each other. You know, we all hated each other's guts, unless they had the cocaine, in which case everybody loved each other.
Bloody hell!
Well, there was because amongst its differences. I mean, even I think I tried to allude about this in my piece was that everything about it, including the drugs, were different. It wasn't. You know what I mean? It wasn't that kind of heavy laden American rock that still was very much into. It was still very much everyone was going to have a heroin overdose.
Yes,
this was for me. It was great because it was much more the tradition of things like Northern Soul, which was about being, you know, a mod. Britpop was a kind of mod for the 90s.
It was good haircuts. And it was quite speedy and clean.
And it was about being remarkably alert at 3 o'clock in the morning.
How did they do that?
We just got lots of sleep.
Our
greens. That's what we did.
Well, actually, one thing I think that people tend to forget about Britpop was that it wasn't a thing happening on its own. It was very symbiotic with what was happening in dance music at the same time. Because you'd go and see a rock band, and then a DJ would come on, and they'd be on until 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And this idea that there was this kind of world of people with guitars and this world of people with drum machines.
They wanted to replicate those highs that were going on in that whole movement as well. Yeah, absolutely.
So there was a lot of ecstasy going down as well in the world of guitar bands, which hadn't happened before, and that gets you things like Dogman Star and other strange outcrops of Britpop.
Absolutely. But I think what do you think were the best bits? I mean, I remember like Louise, I just remember a lot of it being quite good fun.
Yeah.
There was a lot of kind of silliness that, looking back, seems, you know, there was a lot of people riding around on scooters and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But with hindsight, it does seem rather silly. But it was kind of, for about 20 minutes, it was really good fun, wasn't it?
It was.
What I remember most about it, the brilliant thing I remember was that at long last, like, people like us have got our moments. You don't have to spend your time looking up to American bands and long-established rock bands who've been there forever. It's you know, people like us are in the bands, doing the magazines, and they're starting to appear on the radio.
Yeah.
And finally, you can see somebody like Jarvis or somebody like you on the telly and go, I know people like that, and they sing about the things.
It's
that...
It's true, but then what was quite strange is that then, even though there were those type of people in the charts, then you find yourself doing quite strange things. So then you'd still be expected, and why not, to go on Richard and Judy or be interviewed by sort of Zig and Zag, you know? So it's like, we think we're really cool and hip, and we're in an indie band, we don't do that sort of shit. And then you're sort of talking to Zig and Zag on the breakfast show.
Zig and Zag,
what's happened?
I think there was a wonderful and honourable tradition of bands doing that, from the Beatles onwards. There's a great clip of Morrissey and Johnny Marr on something like number 43.
Yeah.
Or 46, it was called, wasn't it?
Yeah, that bus thing.
70.
Number 73.
Sorry, it's been a long day.
And one of the kids says, where are we going?
You know?
Yeah. One of the kids says to Morrissey on the Number 73, where are we going? Morrissey says, we're going to hell.
That's right. and that's in the great tradition of like the Beatles being on, you know, Morecambe and Wise and things like that. I think all pop bands should
absolutely
do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know? This is about the only thing the Clash were wrong about. The Clash, we never do Top of the Pop, we never do those shows. They were wrong about that. You should do that.
To the Clash, what they always said in this quote, the second part of the quote is on, obviously, they said, we're not doing Top of the Pops because it stinks, but we would love to do the Val Dunican show.
All right.
They actually said, we don't want to do that kind of rubbishy pop show, but if you want us to be on the Val Dunican show, we will. Sadly, they're still waiting for Val's invite.
Val Dunican. What? But you know what the thing is, though, about that, all of that? But the Britpop bands, they said, yeah, we can do it, but we'll do it ironically.
Yes, it was all very ironic.
So it was everything. It was. And that's what's rubbish about it. It's like, just do it and do it for real. So it was like, it became so, you know, it kind of sort of crawled up its own bum through its own irony,
it
its own
the
sense
scene
of
that
irony.
Celebrates.
Yeah, no,
do you remember that phrase? The scene that celebrates itself? That's a snappy phrase, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank God someone came up with Britpop.
Yeah. Thank God for that.
Who was that then?
I don't know. It was a team of marketing consultants, I was told.
Yeah.
I
it was me.
No, actually, in Luke Haynes' very brilliant book. Has anybody read Luke Haynes' book? Bad Advice. It's fantastic. wheel gets slagged off in it.
I mean, oh, yeah, I know. But Luke's like one of those Japanese prisoners of war. It's over, Luke.
Yeah.
Come out now.
But he does describe Ripple as being cooked up by a lot of sort of terrible lieutenant colonel marketing consultants. I'm really going, that's me.
That's me.
I'm so proud.
If you'd like to get each and every Word podcast a whole day early, have access to all the hundreds of Word podcasts we've done over the last 5 years, and want to keep in touch with everything going on our website, then you need the Word podcast app for iPhone and iTouch. The Word podcast is the form of entertainment that civilization has been working towards. A bunch of people stuck in a wardrobe talking utter bollocks. Search for the Word podcast app on iTunes. It costs £3.99, practically giving it away, as opposed to actually giving it away, which is what we've been doing so far.
Let's talk for a minute about the thing that everybody sees as the kind of the sort of the outside world as the crystallisation of the Britpop thing, which is Blur versus Oasis. Both bands release a single on the same day. It's the Battle of Britain. It gets on the news. It's all so exciting. I think history has now shown that it was actually Damon Albarn was the instigator of this, hasn't it? Isn't this the case?
Yes, he was.
Yeah. Everybody sort of said, it wasn't our idea, we didn't want to do it, but I think we now know, don't we?
Well,
do we?
What's your version of it?
Hang on, a voice on the floor. It's Andy Saunders. Was it?
Well,
okay.
Yeah, it was. It was. I seem to remember that it was beginning to simmer out, and I was somewhere with Andy one day and Damon, and Damon said, words to the effect of, F it then, let's put them out on the same day. So I think it was, yeah.
And now with hindsight, we can see they both put out one of their worst records they ever made.
Country
House, a record that Graham Coxon couldn't bear to play, and Roll With It, which is now just a punchline for the burger vans out here. Do you want to roll with it?
Yeah.
Neither of these are great records, but it was a great moment. It was an exciting
moment. And if you look at
the
Country House video, you can see the sheer torment Graham is in at that point, aren't you? He's looking, well, apart from all the money and stuff, he's thinking, please make this stop. Not the money, though. Yeah.
Louise, what was your perspective on that particular brouhaha?
On the Blur Oasis?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think they loved it, didn't they? I think it was just a big old game. And that was another thing about, you know, Britpop had this sort of pretense that you didn't care about your chart position, you wouldn't worry about all of that stuff. That was for those pop bands over there.
Yes.
But everyone was fretting like crazy about their chart positions and worrying and listening to marketing groups and focus groups and feeding back. So, you know, it was kind of, you know, everyone likes to pretend that those kind of bands weren't corporate, but they were just the essence of corporate as well. And that, I think that was represented in the whole Blur Oasis battle. And Damon instigating it. They loved that stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
this was also the moment when it all started to get a bit sort of aligned on class, wasn't it? It's like, here's your poncy middle class art school Blur band.
Yes, there
with
was
their weird names and your proper horny handed Sons of Toil.
Well, yeah,
from the north, there's where the real people live.
In there's two things about that. In Richie famously said, in my book about Blur, I take a quote from Richie. Richie famously said, brilliantly, all rock and roll is homosexual. Richie from the Manics, all rock and roll is homosexual. And I paraphrased it. Well, also, you could say all rock and roll is suburban, which it isn't. But Britpop was very suburban as well. For once, it wasn't people coming from. It was people coming
inner
from.
Cities,
it wasn't people coming from inner cities. It wasn't in a city viewpoint. You know, it was largely but suburban. Would you agree with that?
I think it was. And which sort of lended so much imagery to all the lyrics and all the kind of the videos and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but it was part of it. Yeah,
but that's what I was going to say. Then the Oasis and Blur thing became this. It really got co-opted into being this. And you would get Blur soon. Yeah, well, including mainly. Let's face it, Oasis themselves all the time. Saying we don't want the chimney sweep music or whatever they said, something which is actually quite funny, come to think of it.
It is quite funny.
But I'm trying to bill it as a kind of
class war,
which is interesting because I was interested in class war as anybody else was thinking. Not like this.
Not like this,
lads. Because no one wants to. I don't want to be on your side.
Yeah, do you want to be in my gang? Yeah. Not particularly. Yeah.
Do you think anyone really cared though about it?
I think people did care because it was competitive.
For a while.
Hands up, who cared about Blur versus Oasis? We've got a little bit of, and the rest of you are lying. You were all glued to the telly.
Was it not just like who's got the best tune?
Both tunes were pretty bad. Yeah. It has to be. Yeah.
But generally,
yeah.
They were sorry.
They were attitudes.
Good point from the floor. Yeah. Yeah. Did anybody put money on it? No, but you could make quite a few quid on that. I think the Blur Oasis bit was when it started to go a bit sour because you started to see you sort of see some quite well-heeled figures suddenly affecting a bingley-mongley monkey. Oh, Kevin and Penny.
We're not going to name the guilty.
We won't name any names.
Yeah, or something like. I met quite a few. We're both from the north, and I met quite a few people from Cheshire who suddenly decided to start. I was like, hang on, what's happened to you? Have you been some genetic reprogramming? What's all this about? Hi, Stuart, how are you doing, mate? I'm fine, but something really odd has happened to your voice.
Yeah. The Kevin and Perry sketch where Perry says, school is where he teach you how to be stupid. That was replicated.
Yeah.
And then and it did sort of start to go a little bit sadly, because that, I think, to me, that was the moment when Britpop started to stop being about, let's have bizarre ideas from the fringes. Let's bring all the outsiders in and let them do what they want. And it started to get a little bit sort of codified, that it was about being a lad, that it was about being art-based.
And it never was. In the beginning, it was never about being a lad. It was the opposite of that. Yeah,
it was about being a big girl's blouse in the beginning.
Yeah, it was. For me, definitely.
Yeah, well, nice for the lads as well to be a big girl. You know, it's a very liberating kind of thing.
Was there any element of kind of all hanging around, going around each other's houses for tea and drugs and stuff? Were you all just at each other's throats?
No, there was a lot of that. There was, but it was like we said, just hyper-competitive. And people did hang out, but they hung out to take drugs mostly, and have these moments.
What a dreadful thing.
I know, honestly. God, who would have thought it? Pop bands, taking drugs. Unheard of.
What do we think put an end to Britpop? What do we think killed it?
I think it's part of what you were saying, that from the sort of Country House video onwards, that kind of it being assimilated and sort of joining in all those kind of ridiculous rivalries, the laddishness of it, the sort of, you know, the Top Shelf magazine sort of element came into it, didn't it? And the women, I think the women got sort of pushed out of that, and, you know, the women had to start behaving more and more blokishly, and then that got assimilated into something else. It's just, you know, it's like when they started sort of selling Beatles wigs in Woolworths, and you knew that was over, you know?
Yeah, those Blair wigs were awful.
Yeah, they were.
It's like any kind of scene or band. It's like, you know, the Velvet Underground were pretty good and have spawned more rubbish bands than anyone.
Yes.
Same with the Smiths, same with Scenes as well. What happens is that the people who aren't very bright and creative don't get the trappings of it. And I would say, you know, so you get Noel Gallagher with his big, you know, Union Jack guitar thing, which is kind of like, that's a bit naff compared to how it started, to be honest. You know what I mean?
I thought it was quite good, actually. I thought
it was a bit naff.
Right.
And you just think, no, it wasn't about just putting Union Jacks on everything. It was more about emphasising some British working class style virtues over...
That is true.
...over boring American, essentially middle class virtues,
Well, I've got a short...
Well, that's not fair. Kurt Cobain was...
He was good.
Poor,
But he also spawned a load of terrible bands.
That's the thing about Nirvana. Nirvana were fantastic and their records are fantastic, but I'm not including Kurt Cobain, even though we put his name in that headline.
Yes.
I'm not including him in that at all. It was all those bleeding Stone Temple Pilots and Alice in Chains and all that.
Descent at the back there. I've got a list of some things that I think killed Britpop, and they are the Watered Down Power Ballad... the Spice Girls, who ruined everything, destroyed far more than Britpop. Also, the Spice Girls almost destroyed pop music as a thing.
Really? I didn't know you had such a hard line.
They just took it entirely out of anything to do with the joys of pop.
Right.
Well, yeah, exactly.
So you're saying like the Spice Girls were the Thatcher of pop?
I don't know about that. That's what I'm saying to you.
That's a good theory.
Also on the list.
I'm gonna write that down.
Yeah, you can have that one.
Thanks.
Also on the list of things that kill Britpop: bad follow-ups. People making the fantastic album just being unable to sustain it. And the menace of Beatleism. I think too much Beatleism
just
killed
so
Britpop.
Just so much sucking up of Beatles.
Menswear were great.
we love Menswear.
Here's an interesting fact about Menswear. Down the line, they are probably the most successful of those bands, because they've all gone on to manage, haven't they? They've all gone to manage bands.
And, well, Matt works for Six Music.
Yes.
And, all the rest are, that's in a Swiss hideaway managing bands.
Absolutely. Yeah. And compare and contrast with poor old Dixie and Bonehead, whatever they're doing. Menswear have absolutely cleaned up. And last on the list of things that killed Britpop, Be Here Now. Which killed Britpop, killed rock, and actually... paralysed Oasis, I think, creatively for the rest of their lives. This is the irony of Blur versus Oasis, isn't it? You think Oasis win because they get number one, but actually Blur win in the long run because they can become something else, they can change and they can evolve.
Well, I put it this way, the world isn't the world isn't waiting for Liam's opera about a medieval alchemist, is it? You know what I mean? And I said, I said that completely bigotedly. I went to see Damon's opera the other week, and it was quite hilarious because I met him afterwards, and I did think, blimey, when I met you in a pub in Stoke, I didn't think, yeah, in 20 years' time I'm going to be listening to your medieval opera about Dr. John Dee. But that's fantastic. Pop music should have ambition.
It should.
Pop music should have ambition and reach above its station and punch above its weight. It shouldn't be all saying, no, let's keep it down here like me. And keep it real. No, it should have ideas above its station. That's what great pop music always has.
I remember that line from Oasis at the height of their kind of uncriticisable zenith of fame, and somebody said to them, why do you always just stand stock still? Still on the stage, what do you put? And the reply was, if you want to see a show, go to a circus. You know, and
that's completely wrong. Isn't it?
It is utterly
wrong. That is completely wrong. Yes. You should learn something. If it was good enough for the Temptations, it's good enough for you, mate.
He should have been,
you know, learn to do some dancing.
He should have been more like Beyonce, you know, a bit of sparkly pants.
Yeah,
you know, some backing singers, proper again.
Did anybody else think, slightly off the point, the first 10 minutes of Beyonce's set at Glastonbury, though, you wanted to get Bono and get him back out and go, that's how you do it?
I missed it. I was in a field.
Like that old joke about Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. You know the great joke about that Ginger Rogers was the greater talent. She had to do everything Fred did. She had to do it backwards and in high heels. It was like that. It was like, no, she's doing all that you're doing, mate. Except her idea of the rock show is not to lie on your back and feebly kick at the edge of your guitar for 2 seconds before being helped to your feet by paid attendants. Look at what she's doing. Look at her.
Do we think? Yeah, there's a very small smattering of applause there.
Good,
Come on,
sisters.
Come on. Do we think that with hindsight, Britpop gets the credit it deserves? It's kind of been laughed at in the past, in the intervening years.
Oh God, I don't know.
Go on.
I think it gets what it deserves. I think it is. Yeah. It was what it was. It was kind of. To be honest, I'm shocked that people are still talking about it so much. Frankly, I mean, it's like it was a brief little moment, a blip of gorgeous pop madness.
Yeah.
It was almost, you know, it was that. But in terms of having huge cultural relevance and all that kind of stuff, I don't see it so much.
Well, like except with hindsight, you can see that it might actually be the last gigantic pop moment.
Isn't that more to do with the way that sort of the way sort of music's taken now, the way that people get it, the way that people, you know, when Britpop was around, people were still sort of having allegiance to one band or another. It was a real huge thing. It took over the whole country for a little while. But now, you know, everyone's getting it's all Spotify and iTunes and all the kind of way that you get your music.
Yeah.
Maybe that's more of the reason it's dissipated.
Yeah. And it was very symbiotic with the media, wasn't it?
Exactly. And because the media is so huge, it's all because of the way the internet feeds you information in a way. It's not like everyone's going out to buy The Enemy on a Tuesday morning in the same way.
No, they're buying the Word magazine.
Quite rightly.
Yes, rightly so.
But it's not. It's just not the same. So I don't think you're ever going to have that kind of moment again. So is it not more to do with just the way sort of the way that music's?
Well, you may be right. But I take your point that whatever it's to do with, I think you're probably right. It was the last big, national pop moment.
Some people are sort of overly nostalgic about it, or you know, they care about it.
I think for ages people went through a phase about it that people bad-mouthed it so much that you had to say no. And I think now we're coming to a different position saying, no, you know, it was all right. Yeah. It was all right.
Did anybody go and see Pulp in Hyde Park? Yes. I did it as well. Wasn't it amazing? It was an orgasmic recollection of how brilliant all that stuff was. Because you'd been denied it for such an awful long time. And suddenly, here we are, right back. The graphics are the same. Jarvis has got a nice suit on. He's not a bedraggled kind of, you know, trawler man look. And it was just so many people seem to be absolutely ecstatic to be able to revisit that.
It's like sort of rediscovering ABBA were great, isn't it? It's like, you know, because right through the 70s, like, ABBA, shit, we hate ABBA. And now it's like, ABBA, great, we love ABBA. Well, they were just great tunes. They were great bands, you know, it's just...
Had to face the lion myself and accept that Queen were fantastic.
They weren't fantastic.
They were fantastic.
They've got two good tunes.
No, they've got several good tunes.
They were the pantomime Led Zeppelin.
Okay. This is a subject.
That's a
for
good
they word. Fantastic.
Podcast.
I want to disassociate myself from any pro queen sentiment. Some of us will never forgive or forget.
All I just say to you, don't stop me now. That's all.
All I can say to you, three words: fat bottomed girls. We should never let them be forgiven for that.
The champ.
Not listening.
We are the champions. No time for losers, cause we are the champions of the world.
There we go. Anyway.
See.
The mood of the meeting is against you, Mr. Maconey. You should withdraw your proposal.
Please, people listening to this who've downloaded it, email The Word magazine and say, I am right. Don't say, I am right. I'm reaching out to you now through the power of technology.
Okay.
Help me.
All right.
Support me.
All right, never mind that. What did Britpop ever do for us? That's what I want to know.
One thing it did that I think we should say is that we are still just about to have the legacy, although the entire business model of the music industry has collapsed, of course, but we still just about have the legacy that... But before the bands, indie, for want of a better word, bands could get in the charts.
Yes,
and Britpop did that, didn't
they? Yes.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you had hits. The bands had hits. It wasn't just a sort of coterie of people being. It wasn't like Nick Drake. I mean, yeah. I love Nick Drake, but it wasn't like 20 years later, people saying, "Oh, his records are okay," but not being able to get arrested while he was alive.
Yeah,
the bands had hits. They were on. They were on the news. They were on the programmes. And I think still a little bit of that hangs over, that people expect that they can play weirdo music and become successful, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. It definitely did massively expand the audience for music in general, didn't it?
Yeah.
It stopped music being a thing that kind of weirdos who couldn't fight or play football were interested in, and it became something that everybody was interested in.
It sort of became more democratic, didn't it? Because if you give those bands the chance to get on the radio, then people will decide they like them and buy the stuff. It was just getting to that point where you've got to get on the radio and be seen and listened to and heard.
Yeah.
And then it's cast out, and then it's up to punters if they want to buy it or not. So it's kind of, it's always down to that,
which
is brilliant. It's just getting to that point. So it sort of broke through, probably allowing people to get to that point to be heard.
Personally, I think there were a lot of bad records, but the best records are amongst the best ones that have ever been made in Britain and in the world of pop music. And it's, you know,
just where we were waiting. And you had the first Suede album you had on.
Yes.
I hadn't played that record for a while. I'm just hearing it again, thinking, bloody hell, this is fantastic.
Yes, absolutely fantastic.
This is fantastic, and it brought me back to exactly being back in that room at the NME and going, listen to this.
Yes.
Stop listening to that, because that's rubbish and this is better, you know.
Yes.
And it's quite visceral like that.
Listening to Modern Life is Rubbish was a real moment for the first time.
Yeah.
And seeing them play at Reading
fantastic,
when they did that, and it was just... Very early on.
And saying, stop listening to your Queen records and listen to
you can listen to both.
You
it's
can
all
listen
right.
in my
you
house.
Can
you
have
can.
In the wise words of Morrissey, I can have both. So I am going to say it loud. I'm Britpop and proud. Let's have some questions. Round of applause. Let's have some questions from the floor. People.
Hey, chap.
Hang on a minute. We've got a microphone.
We had a series of jokes. We had a series of pop music jokes already. We were going to go, weren't we? It was Kate's joke. We were going to do Kate Moss's joke. We were going to go, okay.
Yes.
Lady in Red.
Okay.
Boy with the thorn in his side.
Yeah.
No.
Girl from Ipanema.
Yeah.
Right.
So man with the child in his eyes.
We've got the man with the child in his eyes down here. Come on, we've got the question.
So,
hey, chap, thanks for turning up. Amazing watching you doing this. This is ridiculous. two things. Can I just ask you what your favourite Britpop bands are? And if you do the history of Britpop, can you include 64 Dolls, please?
64 Dolls?
Because they're incredible. I saw 64 Dolls on tour
with
Sleeper.
Yeah, we played with them.
They were
amazing.
Absolutely amazing.
They were great.
Yeah.
They were really great.
So what are your favourite Britpop bands? Sleeper, obviously.
Obviously, Russell Blur, Oasis. I loved them. Oh. I thought they were both brilliant. Pulp. They were just... They were my three, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know about my bands, the records or albums, I think second Suede album, Modern Life is Rubbish. I'd say that, yeah. Different Class.
I'd have to go for Pulp. I think that Different Class was the most... Hey! I think Different Class is just such an incredible achievement, and the idea that he wrote the lyrics in a very short period of time, fuelled only on a few bottles of red wine, and came out with this incredible body of work that absolutely nailed exactly what it was about at that time. It's written in 1994 and 1995, nailed down into songs.
Yes, you're right.
And I think, was it Ned Sherrin who said...
It usually is.
He said that the lyrics to Common People are like Sondheim. It's that level of proficiency where somebody has gone so far beyond what you'd expect a 14-year recipient from Sheffield to be able to produce. And seeing them perform it again the other week in Hyde Park, I was weeping like a big girl.
What? It was utterly... Oh, no, it is. And what you forget about Common People, which is a true classic pop record, is... Because it's kind of vaguely silly and jaunty on one level, you forget how angry it is as well.
Yeah.
That in the end, when he turns that corner to basically start jabbing his finger and saying, "You'll never know what it's like."
But it's an anthemic song that could actually have occurred at any time. It wasn't. I think that's what's great about it. It transcends Britpop because it's not just about a Britpop moment.
Yeah.
Everyone's felt like that. I could have been someone. It's that Marlon Brando. I could have been someone moment. It's just that distilled into song, and that's why that's just such a brilliant moment.
Well, the fact that it was. That they were able to use the kind of springboard of Britpop
to
you know, suddenly, you know, you're thinking maybe eternal classics can happen now. They haven't all been done in the past.
No,
they haven't all been written by all the good songs are done by 1969. Yeah.
In a way, they're sort of like Park Life feels sort of more the song Park Life feels sort of tied to that moment.
Yeah,
something that Common People doesn't because it's just a larger theme. It's a kind of universality to it. You know.
Yeah. Okay. More questions. Where's the microphone?
There's a gentleman there.
Okay. The man with the golden arm. Yes.
Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yeah.
You spoke about how Britpop was a reaction to the American music scene, but for me, it was also a reaction to the way Britain was at that point. We were a country that was quite demoralised. We had Tories in for what seemed like forever.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know what the panel's views are on that, and whether we think that. With this current disastrous government, 5-6 years down the line, are we going to get another amazing music scene on the way? Or has the music industry changed forever in that respect?
I think personally, because the way the business model of the industry has collapsed, you'll probably not get it so organised now, and there are other things that people can do apart from form pop groups. But I completely agree with you. I think it was not just a reaction, well, from my point of view, I mean, not just a reaction against the bad pro-American music, but an attempt to kind of get revved up about stuff as well. Because if you look, it harks back to an earlier Britain. It's very much of the 90s.
Yeah.
But in the way people are... The dress codes and everything are the 70s and the 60s, aren't they? You know, so.
Yeah. And also the things that, like, the people making those records grew up with. You know, it's like, this is... I'm going to wear the clothes from when I was a teenager and I was happiest.
And we had to put up with shoegazing, for God's sake. You know, it's like, shoegazing. That was the thing. Brilliant.
Yeah.
So we needed some spontaneity and the whole sort of political thing as well. But God, it's just a moment of joy. I think that was needed.
That point you made there about how the political context of it as well. For me, a lot of it felt like we've had miserable teenage lives for such a long time that if anybody's going to make our amazing moment, it's got to be us. We've got to do it ourselves, and that's why I love Pulp above all the bands, because they are the ultimate misfit weirdos. You know, they don't look like a pop group should look like, and they built an incredible thing. On their own terms, and made everybody come to them, and I thought that sort of makes sense in the political context you're talking about. Any other questions? Any other questions? Can I get the microphone up?
You can probably shout, so we'll probably.
All right, shout up.
That's interesting. Yeah.
How important was Radio 1 and the changing of the guard at Radio 1?
That's interesting. Well, I was working there at the time. No, I wasn't. What am I talking about?
I don't remember seeing
you. No, I wasn't. What am I talking about? It was after that. Sorry, I know. It was very important. Yeah, I wasn't there at the time. But it was because there was a new feeling abroad at Radio 1 that... It was about trying to get vaguely hip. It was disastrous for Radio 1 for a while, but there was this feeling that the DLTs and people like that had to go. I think it was because were they very supportive of you?
It was like what we were talking about earlier. It's absolutely crucial. It was just getting out there, being heard, and then it becomes that democratic thing where people choose whether they want to buy your records or not. But it was just getting there, getting out there, getting that exposure. So it was a hugely important moment to get all those bands being played on the radio, and suddenly like these little bands were getting A-listed, and we were running around in Canada like, we're getting A-listed on Radio 1. It seemed unthinkable, and suddenly it was happening, and that was a real sort of catalyst for it.
But it also sort of slightly did rob the kind of underground feel, that was the end of the idea that your own bands would always have this kind of heroic struggle against the institutions above them, because after Britpop, the institutions were bang on side for your bands.
That's
they
right.
were hoovering up new bands, insatiable for them, actually, and often lowering the quality threshold unbelievably to, you know... So
yeah, we should say, because Louise mentioned it, and you've mentioned it, people who don't know it, it is, when the Britpop film gets made, a lot of it you can say about the scene, that it was a journalistic creation or whatever, but it was absolutely true that for a while you could go to the Good Mixer in Camden, and it was like the Britpop Youth Club. It was like, oh, look, there's Graham at the bar. Oh, look, there's Louise. You know, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it
was comedy Britpop youth club, yeah.
That's what the film will be called, Comedy Britpop
Youth
Club.
Yeah, that's right, no.
And it'll look like the Double Deckers or something like that.
Oh,
with a jaunty
deckers.
Organ.
Oh.
That's what it should be like, yeah.
Yeah.
We should
Brilliant.
Start working on the film.
Exactly.
Immediately.
Any other questions? Gentlemen over here.
When do you reckon Britpop finished then? Because I still kind of like Warm Jets and Gay Dad. Is that still Britpop or is that too late?
Oh, interesting. Wow. Where do you draw your line?
Well... Well, pop movements don't have a full stop, do they? They kind of peter out. And to me, Britpop kind of went sour and turned into the giant, moany, string-drenched ballad, let's all sit round and be, hold hands and be miserable thing of the late... You said Travis, not me. That's your construction on that, sir.
I couldn't possibly comment.
I don't think it ended. It just turned into something that was a lot less exciting and a lot less fun,
yeah.
And a lot less inspired and a lot less colourful. That's what I think.
Now, they always get diluted, don't they? As pop movements, that's how they all kind of fade away, don't they?
They do fade away.
Yeah.
Yeah. The dreams we have as children fade away.
Yeah.
As the late great Noel Gallagher once said. Yes. Any more? Was that a hand or was that give me a biscuit? No?
Okay.
Any more?
I do think it is quite sweet that we've had this discussion with tea and biscuit.
Yes. We had to sit down and have some sugary tea.
Absolutely.
Thank you all so much for coming. And we will see you down the front for Suede, where I shall shirt and Liz and I will all be spanking our behinds with these microphones here. Like an animal. Thank you and goodbye.
If you've been affected by any of the issues in this podcast, go to wordmagazine.co.uk or apply at your newsagent every month.